Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Before we get going today, I can't believe it, but it's episode 41 of the podcast. So I just wanted to pause for a second and say a big thanks to you, the listener, for your support since we launched in January. Although we're based in Canada, it's been really meaningful and humbling and honestly really cool to see how many international listeners we have and to know that in some small way, the content we are generating is having such a far reach. If you're brand new to the podcast, welcome aboard, and I hope you find a lot of value in our content. Speaking of, if you find the podcast adds value for you, we would really appreciate if you would consider writing a review for the podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. This will really help us to continue to grow the podcast and generate lots of cool content for you to take in every week. Finally, before we get to the podcast itself, I just wanted to briefly share what I think is an important perspective around the content discussed in this episode. In our discussion today, author and journalist Bob Whitaker shares what he has learned during and since the writing of his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which seeks to not only put the development and use of psychotropic medications in historical context, but also critically examines the long-term impact of these compounds from a very data-driven lens. It is important to stress that neither Bob nor I are medical professionals. This is a general discussion around psychotropic medication that should not be used to guide anyone's decisions around whether psychotropic medications are a fit for them or a loved one. Really, at its heart, this is a discussion to foster critical thinking around the use of these compounds, as well as the predominant narrative that we've all been using to conceptualize mental illness. As I hope will be clear from the first part of the discussion, I'm trying to come at all the issues discussed on the podcast from a place of open-ended curiosity and humility. Quite frankly, I'm less confident now around my ideas of what mental illness actually is than I was 10 years ago. So I guess like everybody else, I'm just trying to figure it all out. Bob's book is extremely well-researched, and as you'll see from our discussion, he's extremely conversant with respect to the literature on psychotropic medications. If our discussion today prompts questions around the role of pharmaceuticals in your overall treatment strategy, I encourage you to read his book for yourself and to speak with your medical professional. Now on to the episode. Robert Whitaker is an American journalist and author who has won numerous awards as a journalist covering medicine and science, including the George Polk Award for Medical Writing and National Association for Science Writers Award for Best Magazine Article. In 1998, he co-wrote a series on psychiatric research for the Boston Globe that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. His first book, Mad in America, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. Anatomy of an Epidemic won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism. He is the publisher of madinamerica.com. All right, Mr. Bob Whitaker, welcome to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Of course, it's been a busy time in the United States these last couple of days.
It sure has been watching the news, and I've been struggling to stay off social media just to keep from getting swallowed alive into the whirlpool that it is at the moment. But wow, what an interesting time.
It is indeed. Really scary. I mean, it was, anyway. Don't want to get me started. That's all I'll talk about for the next hour.
That's another podcast, exactly. So, Bob, if you can indulge me for a moment, I just wanted to take a minute or two to contextualize why I think it's so important that you're here today to share the Anatomy of an Epidemic story with the audience. My first round of graduate training was in behavioral neuroscience, and it was only later in my career that I migrated over to the clinical world, maybe about 10 years ago. And I was very much invested in biological models of mental illness, and the idea that pharmaceutical compounds could act to improve the symptoms of mental illness, that seemed completely intuitive and really sound based on the kind of training that I had had. However, after 10 years of clinical practice, a number of really confusing observations, and I have to point out they're just that, just observations, certainly not any sort of a scientific study, a number of these really confusing observations have piled up. Specifically, while I've seen the medication be life-changing for some clients, what I've also seen is a lot of clients go on medication with no effect or with terrible side effects. I've had some clients have dramatic and debilitating effects from even just starter doses, right? From the moment that that compound gets into their system, and sometimes they're never able to even reach a therapeutic dose. I've had clients claiming that they cannot get off medication while having others stop massive amounts of medication overnight with seemingly no impact. That's been really hard to reconcile. I've seen no clear strategy for prescribing these compounds. It seems a lot more like trial and error. And I've also seen a huge increase in polypharmacy. In addition to this, I've seen many clients come in with prescriptions for medication fresh off the heels of life events that would quite understandably be expected to cause life distress, like a divorce or being unemployed. I've also seen a lot of what I would consider to be normal reactions to life framed as psychopathology, either through formal diagnosis or through self-diagnosis. Most recently, I've had three very respected psychiatrists on the podcast essentially indicate that if antidepressants work at all, for the vast majority of clients, they simply promote a form of apathy that mollifies the worries of everyday life, and that they can actually be really counterproductive to treatment goals. So, all this to say, while I started out my career feeling like I knew something about mental health and mental illness, I now wonder whether I know anything. I've had Dr. Randy Nessie, the author of Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, on to talk about the evolutionary significance and utility of our emotional mind. I've had Dr. Alan Francis on recently, author of Saving Normal, to talk about diagnostic inflation and all of the sort of strange conundrums that are built into the DSM platform. And I'm really hoping today that you can continue to round out the story we're trying to tell on this podcast by speaking to what you've discovered during and since the writing of Anatomy of an Epidemic.
Well, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure being here. I mean, what you just described is sort of a big picture story. I mean, what happens is professionals get trained into a certain belief system. It's presented as fact, okay? I mean, you weren't trained to say this is an ideology or this is a guild story. You were said this is scientific fact. And as professionals go into graduate schools or training programs, they're conditioned to think that they're being told a scientific truth, okay? And once you start seeing the world through us, so you go through and you spend all this time to become a professional, and you're sort of inducted into a club, you know, a club that knows. You want to see in your, because you talked about your clinical experience, you want to see in your clinical experience something that reinforces your intellectual training. Now, that intellectual training is so strong for clinicians, and you become so invested in it, you can shut your eyes to being seen what you're seeing clinically. That happens with a lot of clinicians. And what you see so often when that happens, they say, and here's how they'll save their drugs and their belief. Oh, this person is treatment resistant. It's something within the patient that doesn't make them responsive to our great drugs and our knowledge that we're changing the biology. What is, and by the way, I come at this from a journalist, but I had my own, when you write about medical, so I work for newspapers, et cetera. And from a journalist, when you cover science, you're sort of inducted into the same conventional story. So, for example, I believe that researchers had discovered that depression was due to too little serotonin, you know, that chemical imbalances were the cause of these disorders, and you could fix that. And I had the sense like, this is an amazing discovery. They have discovered the molecule in the brain that makes you depressed or the molecule that makes you psychotic. And I believed it, you know, because I was a lover of science and, you know, you do interviews, call somebody up and it'd be someone from Johns Hopkins or Stanford or Harvard. Even while I believed it, it didn't sound quite possible. And the reason it didn't quite sound quite possible is the drug. I knew the brain is this unbelievably complex place. Can you really fix a molecule? It just sounded too nice. But those are some of the dynamics that go with the conventional story and then starting to move away from it, from clinical. So you moved away from it because of your clinical observations. Now, for me, what's interesting is your clinical observations are actually what is to be found in the scientific literature if you look at it closely. So that story of very effective drugs, that story of drugs that fix chemical imbalances, it does not exist in the scientific literature. That's the most amazing thing, is there is this story that was used to train people, that was used to guide care, and yet when you dig into the literature, you find something different. So, for example, the efficacy of antidepressants and the new ones to be so great, right? We heard that Prozac's so much better, et cetera. And you just had on three psychiatrists that said, if they do anything, they just sort of dull you out, your emotions, right? That's actually in the literature. You look at the clinical trials of Prozac and the SSRIs, half the time they didn't even beat placebo. And that's even though the trials are developed to make the new drug look good. So that story of drugs that weren't very effective was always in the literature. But that story wasn't told to the public. How about the chemical imbalance story? You actually see in 19, if you try to trace the history of the chemical imbalance story, first of all, you see quite clearly it arises not from understanding what was happening in the biology of people who are depressed or have a psychotic episode, but it arose from understanding how the drugs act on the brain. So drugs, antidepressants, up serotonergic levels by blocking the normal reuptake of serotonin into that presynaptic neuron. So they hypothesized depression is due to too little serotonin. So the chemical imbalance story all arises from understanding how antipsychotics, they block dopamine receptors. So we'll say that psychosis is too much of dopamine. Okay, you make that hypothesis. It actually arises from the 60s, right? Well, then you find when you trace this story in the literature, as early as the 70s, people are going, late 70s are going, no, this is sort of a ridiculous hypothesis, and we're not finding out to be so. And as early as 1984, the NIMH did a National Institute of Mental Health. It's our big research organization in the United States, right? And it's one of the biggest funders of research in the world, of course. 1984, they look at the low serotonin theory of depression and say, we're just not finding it. 1998, you see in the American Psychiatric Association's own textbook, they say about the low serotonin theory of depression, you know, this started from understanding how the drugs work. There's really no reason that the pathology of something should be the opposite of the drug. And not only did they say that the low serotonin theory was basically dead in 1998, they sort of said this was sort of a dumb theory from the beginning. What was being promoted to you? When did you do your clinical training?
I finished my clinical training in 2010, although I finished my experimental PhD in 2004. So a lot of my hardcore academic work would have taken place between 1995 and 2004, essentially.
So did you hear about the chemical imbalance story?
I heard about the chemical imbalance story during my graduate training, right? It was sort of dogma. It was accepted that serotonin was related to depression, dopamine was related to psychosis. It was only really, honestly, after reading your book that I heard anything critical with respect to consideration of that quote unquote story.
So this is one of the problems. So you go to their own textbook and they say, we didn't find it. And the theory was sort of stupidly simplistic. And in 2005, roughly when you're, you know, still there, a man named Kenneth Kendler, who was one of the world's leading experts on this whole hypothesis, says, we just haven't found that these big, simple explanations are true. But that scientific finding, so key to this whole story, was never communicated even to the professional world, which is really a stunning betrayal of the profession, the professionals, as well as the general public. So just to circle back to what you first said, you had a belief system formed by your training and also that your interest in sort of behavioral neuroscience, which sounds like a very hard science. And then you go into the clinical world and you see this spectrum of outcomes that just doesn't fit with that story and you start to question it. For me, it was just, from a journalistic thing point of view is, I'll tell you one of the key moments was I'm doing a story. This was when I was co-writing a series for the Boston Globe. And I'm hearing again and again, these drugs fix chemical imbalances like insulin for diabetes. And I just said, okay, that's great. Wonderful. And like five interviews in a row, I was told this. I said, can you just tell me where I can find that you found that people with depression had low serotonin or where you found that people with schizophrenia or psychotic disorders before going on the drugs had high, overactive dopamine systems. And I swear to God, this is what I was told. Oh, that's just a metaphor. And I said, yeah, I understand like insulin for diabetes is a metaphor, okay? And I said, but where did you actually find it to be so? And they said, we didn't. We use it as a metaphor to explain to people why they should take the drugs. I was gobsmacked. I was like, but you don't tell people they have a physical problem to get them to take drugs. And after the first time I was told that, I called a second person. high up, one of these thought leaders. And he says, yeah, really, we just do this to get people to take their drugs. Then I actually called people from Janssen, the makers of Risperdal. And Risperdal at this time was being marketed to, you know, this is in the 1990s. It's one of the new atypicals, right? And it was being marketed that fixed both serotonin and dopamine in the brain. It fixed all your chemicals. So I actually got to the scientists who had worked on risperidone. And I said, how does this drug fix both serotonin and dopamine? And the person just said, this is so stupid. It acts on those systems, but we have no evidence. Now he's talking to me off the record because he'll get fired. It's just embarrassing that we're promoting this. And that actually was what's one of the things that really started me on this whole thing. I'm saying, well, I'm a journalist. Have I been promoting lies to the public? And what I'm saying is you and I actually shared a common experience. You saw it in your clinical experience. I saw it in the scientific literature that, you know, there was all sorts of greater harms. They weren't really very effective. The trials were biased by design. And then, you know, what I did in anatomy was also add to the question, how about long-term effects? And then you get into the long-term literature and that just gets you into this other frame, you know, path of science that is just stunning, where drugs don't fix chemical imbalances. They actually perturb normal chemistry. And research is even worrying, is this making people more symptomatic over long term? That's a story that's just not, you know, you weren't told this. Practitioners aren't told this.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, Bob, I was wondering if you could tell the listener or walk them through particularly that story with respect to psychosis. I was really struck by that story that you told in the book just around, if you look at the long-term outcomes with respect to the administration of antipsychotics and what tends to happen there. As clinicians, it's often dogma for us that psychosis requires medication, you know, case closed. When we get a client come in who's exhibiting signs of psychosis, one of the first things that we're taught to do is to consider a referral to psychiatry. So again, I'm wondering if you can maybe walk, and again, that's often taken just at face value. I'm wondering if you can walk the listener through what you've discovered in terms of doing a bit of a deeper dive in that area.
You know, I think this is one of the most amazing stories in medical history or medical literature, because in the conventional wisdom, it goes like this. Up until 1955, psychiatry lacked treatments that would prevent people from becoming chronically ill. Then the first drug that we remember as an antipsychotic, chlorpromazine, arrives. Now in the US it was Thorazine. It may have been Largactil in Canada. I'm not quite sure what the brand name was there. But it arrives in 1955. And the idea is it's this drug that makes it possible to empty the asylums. It gets named, it initially was called a neuroleptic, meaning taking control of the nervous system, but it gets renamed an antipsychotic. And think about that word. That's all, like, it's an antidote to whatever causes psychosis. It fits into this antibiotic model. So the common wisdom is it made it possible to empty the asylums, live fairly normal lives, prevented relapse, and fixed the chemical imbalance. That's the larger story, right? Story of great progress. And you see this in textbooks and histories of psychiatry. What you find when you actually look at that history, none of it's true. So first of all, you look at the discharge rates for first episode patients in the years before, say that 5 years before the arrival of chlorpromazine. And then you look at the 5 years after the drug was introduced, and you look at it in different countries. It's the same. It didn't change. So this idea, it led to the discharge, it made it possible for people who lived in the community, is not true. The second thing is, what was the discharge rate from 1950 to 1955 for first episode psychotic patients before they had the drugs? Well, it was about 67%. So in other words, a lot of people got well without going on an antipsychotic, okay? That's one of the first things you see. What's the second thing in the story? You see right away in the 60s, this worry start coming up among clinicians. They go, you know, maybe my patients are getting better a little faster, but it seems like now they're relapsing more often than they used to. They're coming back to the hospital more frequently than they used to. And you actually see that in the research, by the way. They're more likely to relapse. So this begins to set in motion in some clinicians' idea, are we doing something that actually makes people more biologically vulnerable to psychosis? Okay. Now, this appears, by the way, this higher relapse rate appears in the very first sort of significant study done by the NIMH in the 1960s. And what you find is that, so this is the first study that is supposed to say that these drugs are effective. And what you find is, so people are randomized to placebo or to one of three different phenothiazines, antipsychotics at that time. And what you find is the relapse rate at the end of 1 year was higher for the drug-treated groups. And so right away, we get this confusing signal. Why would a drug that maybe diminishes symptoms over the short term, why would it make people more vulnerable, okay? Well, by the 19th, and there are some other studies done. There's a famous study done in the 1970s by the NIMH where they compare newly psychotic people, and they're randomized either to environmental care, this is the Soteria Project, where they minimize use of antipsychotics, or they're randomized to conventional care, and what do they find? Now, this study was directed by the head of schizophrenia studies at the NIMH, okay, Lauren Mosher. They found that those treated outside the hospital with minimal use of antipsychotics, the diminishment of symptoms at 6 weeks was just as great in those people as it was in those treated conventionally with antipsychotics. How about at the end of 2 years, though, when people weren't initially put on medications, antipsychotics? And many people never went on in this other alternative called Soteria. They were doing much better at the end of 2 years, more likely to be in school, less likely to have been rehospitalized, more likely to be asymptomatic, et cetera. So better functional outcomes. So this deepens this story that maybe we're doing things wrong. This is the 1970s, okay? And then comes a key moment. Because by the late 70s, they were seeing people relapsing more frequently. There was another study like this. And then people say, well, what's happening to the person's brain that goes on these drugs? And they had started to fix it, figure it out. Here's what they thought. So antipsychotics work by blocking receptors for dopamine, right? And as your listeners know, you have a presynaptic neuron. This is how neurons communicate, that releases a neurotransmitter into that tiny gap. Dopamine is a type of neurotransmitter. Then that molecule binds with receptors on the postsynaptic neuron, and that's how neurons communicate, okay? When that molecule binds, and then the molecule is released, and it either is taken away as a metabolite or it goes back up into the presynaptic neuron and stored for later use. So what does an antipsychotic do? It gums up those receptors. It blocks those receptors. So you diminish dopaminergic activity. This is why people start to shuffle, feel that maybe they're not emotionally engaged. Now, what happens when you take that drug? Well, what they learned by the late 1970s is your brain being this extraordinarily neuroplastic organ tries to compensate for this blockade. So what does it do? It puts if you're putting a block on it, it tries to maintain what we call a homeostatic equilibrium, a normal functioning. It puts down the accelerator on dopamine machinery. It does it in two ways. The presynaptic neurons put out more dopamine than normal for a period of time. And then that compensatory mechanism seems to burn out after a period of time. Now the receiving neurons, what they do is they increase their number of receptors for dopamine, okay? Sometimes 50% more, double more. So what they actually found by the late 1970s is that the drugs were causing the very physiological problem that they had hypothesized to cause psychosis. Because what it was doing, it was driving the brain physiologically into a dopamine supersensitive state. Now, having found that, they said, well, we do know that putting things into a hyper or dopamine dysregulated state can, in fact, cause trigger psychosis. We know that from dopamine releasing drugs, stimulants, etc. We also know it, by the way, from Parkinson's disease, which is also a dopamine dysregulation disease. So they said, are we making the brain more biologically vulnerable to psychosis? with these drugs. This is late 1979. That question is raised within the NIMH, at the top levels of the NIMH. This would explain why, after you go on the drugs and you're on for a while, it'll explain two things. It'll explain why you come off, you're at high risk of relapse because you've got this change. But they're also saying, even if you stay on, the fact that you've gone over this change, it may lead to what we're going to call tardive psychosis, more persistent and chronic psychosis. And in the early 80s, it was Canadian doctors, by the way, McGill, Guy Chouinard, and was it McGill? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was McGill. Guy Chouinard and Jones put this story together. And then they did a study of their patients and they said, our patients are developing tardive psychosis, where they're chronically psychosis. And they tied it to this change in the brain. Now, what happened to that story? You see how it's completely reversed from what we've been told? That story gets pushed away. People can't deal with it because psychiatry had built its new story around antipsychotics, even more the antidepressants. These were the drugs that gave us a new world. And now to go forward, if you look at long-term recovery rates, so for example, the best long-term study in North America was done by people at the University of Illinois, Martin Harrow and Tom Jobe. They began a study of long-term outcomes for schizophrenia and other psychotic patients. They start this in 1979, and here's how the study's designed. It's going to be a naturalistic study. People are going to come into two Chicago area hospitals, one private and public, and they want the public so they get a diversity of people. Everyone's going to be treated with drugs. Then they're going to be discharged, and now they're just going to follow them for the next 15, 20 years. How are they doing? Every two and a half, five years, they're going to check in, and they say, are you using drugs, antipsychotics? What are your symptoms like? How are you functioning, et cetera? They're going to take this overall view of their lives. Now, they expect that the people who are medication compliant, because this fits with the conventional narrative, are going to be doing the best. They're going to have lesser symptoms, and they're going to be functioning better. What did they find? Well, this is the best study we've had. 200 people are enrolled. At the end of 15 years, they still have 77% of their patients in the study, which is really good for a study of people with schizophrenia and psychotic patients. They found among the schizophrenia patients two things. A, the recovery rate for those who quit taking their medications and got off medications, especially if they got off by year two, and they did this themselves. Okay, there was no tapering protocol, were 8 times more likely to recover. The recovery rate was 40% for those off, 5% for those on. They also found that they were much, once they got stable off, now we all know you go on, you come off, you have a period of high risk of relapse. But those who got stable off medication, they had very low relapse rates. In other words, if they made it through that withdrawal period, they were much more likely to be working, much more likely to be socially engaged, that sort of thing. So this completely set things upside down. And here's the most amazing thing about that study. They end up with four groups: schizophrenia on and off, milder psychotic disorders on and off at the start, okay? Here's how the long-term outcomes ranked among those four groups. The best was milder psychotic disorders off, okay? That got off and stayed off their antipsychotics. The next best was schizophrenia off. That they actually had better outcomes though than those who started with milder psychotic disorders and then stayed on the drugs. Now that tells you that people with a more severe prognosis, a more severe initial case who got off antipsychotics ended up better than those with a milder initial case and a better prognosis who stayed on the drugs. What is that telling you? That's a pretty strong story of drugs that worsen long-term outcomes. And that's what they've eventually said. Are we harming, are these people making this long-term course worse? Now we've had a number of other long-term studies from other countries, Denmark, there's one from Australia, there's one from Norway. They all show higher recovery rates for those off medication. We're talking about psychotic patients. And the final part of this story is there's a group in northern Finland 20 years ago, that reconceptualized psychosis, reconceptualized schizophrenia, and they adopted a model of care where they do a lot of psychosocial care, try to minimize use of antipsychotics, and they found that the course of psychotic disorders completely changed. And they found that at the end of 5 years, with their minimal use, they don't use antipsychotics right away, and then they still try to limit long-term use, 80% of their first episode patients, 5 years out, were working or back in school. In other words, they were socially functioning okay, and were asymptomatic. So in that 5-10 minute little spiel, sorry for going on, you asked about the question about this narrative of antipsychotics, which is they're essential. They fix a chemical imbalance. If you don't take them, you're going to relapse. And yet, if you dig into the science, you find a story of drugs that right away seem to be increasing the chronicity of the disorders. And that's on target symptoms. Forget the tardive dyskinesia. Forget this, all the other negative effects. This is on the symptom of psychosis, that it's increasing the frequency of symptoms, increasing the severity of symptoms on the whole, and that this period, once you go on, where you're at high risk of relapse when you come off, that what you're seeing is that's relapse in people who've had their brains changed. So within the science story, it's like a Alice in Wonderland version, where everything is exactly the opposite. But that story, even though it's in the scientific literature, by the leading researchers, it just doesn't get told to the public.
Bob, to your mind, do you feel like the causation versus correlation aspect of this story has been appropriately fleshed out? I can imagine someone listening with a critical eye saying, hey, maybe it's the case that folks who have more severe symptoms need to stay on antipsychotics longer, thus creating the illusion the illusion of a causal pathway that these medications promote the maintenance of psychotic symptoms over time. Has that question been fleshed out?
Okay, so this is really great. And I do want to say one thing. If you look at the best model for selective use of antipsychotics now, or use of antipsychotics, that did come from the Northern Finland group in Tornio. And here's how they used antipsychotics. And then I'm going to answer your question, okay? When people come in with the first episode of psychosis, they don't put them on an antipsychotic, because they want to see if the psychosis can remit on its own with psychosocial care. And they also feel by not putting people on psychosis right away, that they can bring to the psychosocial, the psychotherapy, the dialogical care, emotional engagement that they think is necessary to start healing. Now, if after someone if someone's not improving what they call their grip on life, which means showering, willing to come to, talking, et cetera, they'll say to the person, maybe an antipsychotic would help you for a while, help you stabilize. And they will put that group then on an antipsychotic, okay? And then after they stabilize and they see some improvement, they'll see who now can come off successfully. So they're really saying, we're going to have three types of people. We're going to have a group of newly psychotic patients who never need to go on. We're going to have another group that needs them temporarily. And then for whatever reason, we are going to have a group that seems to need to be on the medications, okay? Which is about 20% of the group. Also, I'm going to just say, with that model, you're not saying that the drugs have no use, okay?
Right.
And then they're found this. However, your other question is, do they cause changes in the brain that make people more vulnerable to psychosis over the long term? And is that just a correlation or is that a causation? Now, people say, oh, well, you find causation where you equalize everything and then you do a randomized controlled trial and then you can isolate that. Well, first of all, you're never going to have a randomized controlled trial that keeps people in one or two groups for, say, 5 years. You're just not going to have it. So what you look for is, you end up with this outcome evidence, right, where you see high recovery rates. And then you say, well, why is that? And then you want to see what other evidence exists that could explain that, whether it's correlative or causative. Well, first of all, the fact that the drugs cause a physiological change in the brain, this increase in dopamine receptors, and that has been found to be associated with tardive psychosis, that's actually a causative story. You have an outside agent that causes a physiological change, and that leads to make you more vulnerable to psychosis, more severe symptoms, and more chronic symptoms. That's what the Canadian people, by the way, concluded in the early 1980s. That's actually a disease model story, right? You have some outside agent. Let's say it's a bacterial or virus. Let's say a virus came in, doubled, and the virus blocked dopamine receptors, right? And all of a sudden, you get like people who don't walk as freely. And then they do brain studies, and they say, wow, it also causes this increase in dopamine receptors. And then we say, wow, this leads to people becoming more chronically psychotic. You wouldn't call that correlative. You'd call that a causative story because you have this mechanism. So that's one thing where that's fleshed out. And by the way, tardive psychosis, this change also, this increase in dopamine receptors, that correlates with tardive dyskinesia, which is, it's manifest of where you get this motor disability, right? With the tongue coming out and then other Parkinsonian-like symptoms. But tardive dyskinesia is actually associated with a more global dysfunction, cognitive decline, et cetera. And again, Canadian researchers have been at the forefront of this. A guy named Philip Seaman at the University of Toronto, he did it with his animal studies and other studies. He said, A, this is why antipsychotics fail over time, this increase in dopamine receptors. Again, causative. And this is also why it's associated with this increase in with tardive dyskinesia. That is a causative story, okay? Now, there's another causation story with antipsychotics, and that is that can I stop for a second with your people? If people are listening to this, some of this is really upsetting. I know this is upsetting. Please do not make any sort of medical decisions based on what you hear today. Okay, but I do believe in informed consent too. We now know that both the older drugs and the newer drugs, the atypicals, the second generation antipsychotics, they shrink the brain. You go on these drugs and you lose some brain volume in the course of the first year. And it continues over time, but it's most rapid in the first year. And then they have done studies. Now, this stuff doesn't get promoted, that as you get this decrease in volumes, what do you see? Well, you see an increase in the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. These are the lack of emotional engagement. You see some cognitive impairment and some functional decline. That's another causative story. Drug comes in, causes a change in volumes, and that change in volumes is associated with these increased symptoms and deterioration in functioning. So then you want to look at these, like Harrow's study. Does that physiological story, does that fit with his clinical outcomes story? And where you really see that it fits is where people with a more severe initial prognosis, okay, those with schizophrenia, who got off the drugs, end up doing better than those with the less severe diagnosis who stay on. Now, what explanation is for the less severe doing worse than the more severe, other than they're taking an agent that in other worlds is shown to be causative, more symptomatic, more functionally impaired? So what I hear is people say, oh, that's just correlative data, talking about the Harrow data. And they come up with the very explanation you gave. But then I say, A, what about this dopamine increase and that being receptor increase and that being tied to worsening symptoms? How about the brain volume research? And how about what I just talked about Harrow with, it's the people with milder initial symptoms who stay on who do worse than those with more severe who go off. To my mind, that is a powerful piece of causational evidence. It's much more than correlative data.
So, Bob, what concerns me about this story is, you know, in Canada anyway, we have about 1 in 5 people on an antidepressant at any given time. And certainly there's much less people who are on antipsychotics, but you know, there's a lot of folks in the population who are taking antidepressants. Is there any emergent or established evidence around whether antidepressants may act in a similar manner to sensitize the brain or render it more vulnerable? I mentioned off the hop that, you know, I have clients who seem to have trouble getting off of antidepressants. They have to stay at a very low maintenance dose in order to, you know, maintain their quality of life and functioning. So is there, without trying to ask it as a loaded question, is there a similar story around antidepressants, which are very widely used?
Yeah, you know, absolutely, unfortunately, and tragically. In fact, you can find some articles now saying that this is a universal problem with psychiatric drugs. And the way one researcher put it, he said, psychiatric drugs, they work by perturbing normal neurotransmitter systems. In response to that, the brain goes through this compensatory adaptation in which the attempt to compensate for the drugs present is the opposite of what we wanted the drug initially to do. So an antipsychotic blocks dopamine, you get this hyperactivity in the dopaminergic system, this increase in dopamine receptors. What happens when you go on an antidepressant? And by the way, one of the guys who wrote about this, Reef L. Malik, used to work for Eli Lilly. This isn't coming from some, you know, person who's got some other horse to ride. So we call them SSRIs, Prozac, when they come in. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So what does that mean? So to go back to this mechanism of action, that means the presynaptic neuron, it releases serotonin into that synaptic gap, right? Like the cleft. Serotonin binds with receptors on the receiving neuron. And now, in order to have, that's the messaging system. Now, in order for that messaging system to be crisp, you got to, it binds, and then it is released, and then the serotonin needs to be taken out of that gap, okay? This is the normal functioning. And it's either an enzyme comes along and metabolizes it, and the metabolite is carted off as waste, or it just goes back up into the presynaptic neuron and it's stored there for reuse. That's how evolution designed the system to work. Now you take an SSRI, what it does is it blocks that normal reuptake into the presynaptic neuron, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. That's describing what it does. Serotonin stays in that gap longer than normal, so it's upping serotonergic activity because it can keep on binding with the postsynaptic neurons. What does your brain do? What your brain does, trying to maintain this normal functioning, it's the same thing. Initially, the presynaptic neurons try to put out less serotonin, right? Because you've got the accelerator on. And the postsynaptic neurons, they decrease the density of their receptors for serotonin. So what happens when you go on an SSRI? You drive your body, your brain, into a subsensitive serotonergic state. Another, once again, physiologically, the drug creates the very abnormality hypothesized to cause the problem in the first place. And then second, they don't find that people have the serotonergic abnormality before they go on the drug. But now let's look at the course of depression to see if that same model, that we can see that same story emerge. So go back into the 60s before antidepressants became seen as prescribed, you know, on a regular chronic basis. Okay. Well, first of all, what did researchers know about the course of depression? And we're talking about hospitalized depression. We're not talking someone who's having a little problem and these are people who go into the hospital. It was seen as an episodic disorder. And it was seen as maybe it's going to take a month to, lift. Maybe it's going to take 2 months. But if you look at people hospitalized for depression, 85, this is before the antidepressants, 85% would be discharged within 12 months, okay? And then if you follow the group of hospitalized patients over long term, it would sort of go like this. So we begin with 100 patients hospitalized for depression. 85% are discharged within 1 year, but 50% would never have another episode. So it would be a single episode of depression. Another 35, that other there'd be like 30% that would have maybe an episode every 3 years. So it was seen as sort of an episodic illness that recurs every 3 or 4 years, but there'd be a time in between when they would be fine. And then there would be like 15, 20% that became more chronically depressed. So that was our understanding of depression before the antidepressants. And because of that understanding, if you go back to the literature in the 60s and early 70s, and this is people at the NIMH, they said, well, it's going to be tough to improve on that 85% recovery rate, but you know, it hurts to be depressed. Maybe we can speed up the recovery rate. So that was the idea in the late 60s, early 70s. And what do you see in a few clinicians in the 70s? You see, yeah, maybe my patients, severely depressed patients, are getting better faster, but it seems like they're relapsing more frequently. The same thing shows up. And then there's a study done in Europe in the 1970s, and they find out, yeah, patients given antidepressants relapse back into depression more frequently than they would be in the normal course of the illness. And now, at that time, what's happening is people are going on the drugs, they're getting out, they're stopping the drugs, and then they're more likely to relapse. So at this point, they're not necessarily staying on the antidepressants long-term because it was never understood that you really needed that long-term treatment. So now go forward into time, and you find that medicated depression clearly runs a much more chronic course than it used to, meaning that people who get treated for depression go on an antidepressant, 2, 1, 2, 5 years later, they're more likely to still be symptomatic than if a never exposed group. And that comes across in study after study after study, and we can talk about them. And so by the early 1990s, there's researchers saying, are we with antidepressants causing a chronification of depression? A lot of studies, basically, if you follow that forward, it basically echoes the antipsychotic trial. The most visible evidence, by this way, were two studies done by the NIMH in real world patients, okay? There's three studies really that bear on this. One was a study that just took, it was a smaller study, real world patients, not hospitalized patients. People just coming into an ordinary clinic. They're going to get the best care and they're just going to see how they're doing in this real world setting. Initially, how many remit and then how many are well at the end of 1 year? Well, first, the remission rate was only, what was it in this study? I want to say it was only like 25% or something. But the key thing was how many were well at the end of 1 year? It was 6%. 6% treated with antidepressants. And you see the researchers going like, this is really a low recovery rate at the end of 1 year. Then we had something called the STAR-D trial, which was the largest antidepressant trial ever conducted. 4,041 patients. And the idea was, we'll have real world, these are people coming into clinics, not hospitalized, and we're going to give them real world care. If you don't respond to the first drug, we'll give you a second drug. Maybe we'll throw in some psychotherapy. You can get different tries to remit. Four different tries. We'll start with one drug. Maybe we'll then go to one drug plus psychotherapy, et cetera, et cetera. But at one point, you can have a try with four different drugs. And then if you remit, in other words, if you fall below, I think it was 8 or 7 on the Hamilton scale, we're going to whisk you away to the follow-up trial, and we're going to see if we can keep you well at the end of 1 year. And when they launched this trial, the NIMH said, this is going to be the study that guides our thinking about antidepressants, how to use them, and their impact on real-world populations. And you see, we're going to disseminate these findings really far and wide. Well, what happened in that study? First of all, the report of outcomes, and we can go into this, was completely fraudulent. And I can explain how they did that. But here's the bottom line. Of the 4,041, only 38% ever remitted, okay? They got below that 8. And then at the end of the year, out of the 4,041 patients, and by the way, when you got put into that follow-up trial, they paid you to stay in and they could change drug dosages and all. At the end of that trial at the end of 1 year. You know how many were well and still in the trial? 108. It was a 3% recovery rate. Now, remember what the natural course of depression was. Anyway, then the NIMH also did a study in the late 90s saying, well, what is the natural course of depression today? Because we really don't know, right? So they ran a trial to figure this out, and it was really interesting. At the end of 1 year, 85% unmedicated patients were well, just like it was before the era of the antidepressants. And what was so interesting was, so let's say after 1 month, I think about, see if I can get this right. It was only about 20% who had recovered after 1 month, okay? 20 to 25%. Now, you worked with depressed patients. Depression can be painful. I mean, it hurts. It's not just the absence of feeling. It hurts, right? It's tough. And then they found that basically every week in this one trial, another 2% would get better. So 20% after 1 month, and then now we're at 30% after 2 months. And it just came to be a collective increase such that by the end of 1 year, 85% were better. And you see the researchers go, boy, it'd be hard to get a therapy that improved on this natural recovery rate. So just think about, we put these two studies together. Largest study ever done, 3% recovery rate, another about 6 at the end of 1 year. The unmedicated course, 85%. And there is a researcher in Italy named Giovanni Fava since the 1990s who's been saying, I think we're increasing the chronicity of this disorder. He looked at the biology of it, the same explanation. And now we've had other long-term antidepressant studies, and time again, you're seeing more chronicity. In other words, for people who go on antidepressants, they're more likely to be antidepressed 1 year, 2 year, 5 years later. They're also more likely to be on disability. They're more likely to have gone on to bipolar and to have some sort of functional impairment. Now, one key thing with this, so Refael Malik, he's one of the people who's written about this. You know how you often hear about treatment-resistant depression?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that he's saying that is drug-induced depression. In other words, that's antidepressant-induced depression. And he calls it tardive dysphoria. And that's an interesting description because he's saying, okay, maybe people in this state show up as still depressed, but he says it's really not a depressed state. It's an unfeeling state. It's a dysphoric state. So whereas depression is an emotion that is strongly felt, right? That initial depression, it's a physical thing. It hurts. What they're saying with tardive dysphoria, it's like, I don't give a damn anymore. I can't actually mount an emotional response. And there's all sorts of other causative data out there related to sexual dysfunction and that sort of thing related to tardive dysphoria. So what they're saying with antidepressants, first of all, even over the short term, the benefit over a placebo is really minor if it exists. But over the long term, you're at increased risk of becoming dysphoric. And that is associated with this change in the brain. You've driven your brain into a subserotonergic state. And because the serotonin system is such a primary system, you might get dysfunction or less functionality in a lot of systems. And now we go to the withdrawal data. Why do people have so much trouble going off the drug? Well, it's because their brain has adapted to it. And here's the problem. Why do you get protracted withdrawal symptoms in people who are all the way off? Well, the thought is those brain changes, we always used to think you come off the drug, they'll renormalize. Well, there's some evidence that in a certain percentage of time, they don't renormalize. And that's why you can't come off, why it's so hard to come off and why you have protracted symptoms. And by the way, Refael Malik, 2013 paper, he says, these drugs cause changes in the brain that may make you more vulnerable to depression, and they may not be reversible even after you go off the drug. Now, if that message was promoted to the general population when they had that problem you were talking about, divorce, loss of job, whatever might be going on, you'd think twice about going on that drug. But that information isn't part of the informed consent process.
And Bob, is that also true of anxiolytics like the benzos or perhaps even like stimulants that are like Vyvanse, Concerta that are prescribed, it seems, to everybody? That's not true, obviously, but the rise in stimulant prescription is just going through the roof. I guess in a nutshell, are there similar stories evolving around those compounds as well? Again, which is, I think, really quite relevant given the wide-ranging prescription of these compounds.
There certainly is around benzodiazepines, okay? So what benzodiazepines do, they work in a bit different manner. So, you know, the brain's unbelievable, right? How it works. It's so complex. So they have some neurotransmitters that are excitatory, okay? Dopamine and serotonin, they cause the second neuron to fire. But you also have neurotransmitters that naturally act as a brake on that activity. They act as inhibiting neuronal activity. And one of those molecules, neurotransmitters, is called the GABA neurotransmitter. And it is meant to act as a brake on neuronal activity so it doesn't go too crazy, right? Well, what does a benzo do? It amplifies that GABA molecule, so it steps down on the brake, okay? So and think about it. You take a benzodiazepine and you're like, okay, I don't care. My emotions are now quieted, et cetera. That's because if you've inhibited neuronal activity for mounting emotional reactions. And we also know, like, you fall asleep with these drugs, you're not supposed to drive, some of you're impaired. All that's because you've inhibited neuronal activity. So what does your brain do when you take a benzo every day for 30 days? Well, its own GABA machinery begins to diminish. In other words, think of a car for a second. You have a car, you have an accelerator and a brake, right? That's its natural thing. So what happens when you take a benzodiazepine, it's like stepping on the brake harder, but then the brain itself loses its own braking machinery, okay? That goes into disuse. Now you take away the benzodiazepine, and what do you've got going? You've lost your normal inhibition or your normal braking capacity on these excitatory messages. So what you find when people, think about what the symptoms are when people come off benzodiazepines. They'll talk about like insects crawling over my body. All the things they're talking about, extreme panic, extreme anxiety, are of neuronal systems that are in a hyper-excited state. And that's because you've lost your ability to inhibit those or brake on those, which are part of how the brain functions. And that's why you get withdrawal symptoms with benzos, and why you get protracted withdrawal symptoms. And the researchers who have looked at that are saying this is the same conceptual model of what's going on. Now, stimulants is an interesting case. I haven't actually seen the same story so clearly in the literature around stimulants. I've seen some hints of it, but not to the same extent as with antipsychotics, antidepressants, and benzodiazepines. And so you always want to be careful. I mean, stimulants, of course, are upping dopamine activity. So you think the brain would go through some sort of diminishment of its dopaminergic capacity. And if that were so, okay, if you drive your brain into a physiologically subdued dopaminergic state, you might worry later on that people who are on stimulants as kids would not be able to feel as much joy, okay? Because they don't have this dopamine reward system that they would have normally. Now, there is some evidence of that with animal research. I just haven't seen it with human research so much. But it's definitely there in the animal research, and people cautioned about it. But so I don't know what the stimulants is the point.
So, Bob, with all that you've learned, if you had to write the informed consent document to be presented to a client prior to considering going on a course of psychotropic medication, what information would you feel that it would be critical to include for that client to be able to consider?
Well, this is what we need. We need honest information presented to people at that moment of choice. And remember, informed consent is supposed to be at the center of the doctor-patient relationship. Well, here's what should be on there. We don't know that you have anything physiologically wrong with you. Okay? Now, there are physiological things that, you know, you can have, take a poison, or you can have an illness that can cause psychiatric difficulties. Parkinson's does, et cetera. Poisons do, et cetera. But that's not what we're talking about, right? We're talking about where we haven't identified some neurological illness or something like that. So we would say, first of all, we don't know anything that is abnormal with your brain. Second of all, these drugs are going to perturb normal functioning, and that's going to cause your brain to respond to that perturbation. It's going to change your brain. Okay, so that's a profound thing to do. Okay. Now, what do we know about that over the short term? Say you go on an antidepressant. Well, you may have these side effects, sexual dysfunction. You may be at a little increased risk of turning bipolar. That's true. Have a manic reaction. What's your chance? This is really key. That you'll have a positive response on an antidepressant that you wouldn't have without that. It's called NNT, the number needed to treat. So if you look at the antidepressant literature, now this is from clinical trials, which are designed to make the drug look good. You'll see that maybe 50% of people treated with the drug are seen as having a significant response, meaning that their symptoms drop by more than 50%, okay? Now, in the placebo group, it might only be 38% have that same response. So what do you see here? You see in the drug-treated group, 50% didn't have a response, a significant response. 38% would have had the response anyway, right? That's from the placebo group. So what you get is 12% of people have a significant diminishment of symptoms that otherwise they wouldn't have had. And so what's known is this is the number needed to treat. You have to treat 8 people in order to get one additional significant response. That should be part of the informed consent, because then I can say to you, listen, from the clinical trials, it looks like you have a 1 in 8 chance to have a better response than if you didn't take the drug. But that also means that 7 of 8 are being exposed to the adverse effects without any additional benefit. So that should be part of the risk-benefit equation. And then we should talk about, how about long-term impact? Well, longer term, you have to worry about this chronicity, and we could give you the studies. And we also have to worry about getting off them, maybe very difficult. Because you're going to have these withdrawal symptoms. So that's what the informed consent should have. Right now it might have, oh, here's some side effects you might have, but you don't see the NNT. So we should say, it's going to change your brain. We don't know anything wrong with you. It's going to change your brain physiologically. And that's going to, and you're going to have some adverse effects, risks over the short term. Here's the NNT. Benefit over the short term, and then here's the long-term effects, and then you know what? Let people make the choice. But it should be within an informed consent context, and that's not happening. And by the way, one last thing, that's for adults. Kids are not getting an opportunity to make any choice, basically. They're being put on this without giving informed consent. It's the guardianship, the parents and all, and the parents aren't being told about this larger informed consent as well. So my whole plea is, let's take this science, let's educate people about NNTs, let's educate them about long-term effects, these changes in the brain, and then two things. The profession, clinicians, will have this information. They can have this discussion with their patients. And personally, I don't think many people with a common problem, I'm divorced, or I've lost my job, would look for the quick fix. And by the way, final thing on this, and again, a lot of this research has come out of Canada, by the way. There's a guy named Paul Andrews. He was at McMaster's. Where's McMaster's? That's the
Hamilton, Ontario.
Hamilton, it's close to you, yeah. He's done this piece looking at, well, maybe depression, when you have setbacks in life, has an evolutionary purpose. It's a signal to make some changes in your life. Maybe with diet, exercise, socialization. Maybe your job sucks and you're not finding it meaningful. And he's even saying, like, are you taking away this evolutionary signal that is there for a purpose? So we just need a whole different discussion around these drugs, because they're handed out as if there's an automatic benefit and the risks are minimal. That's how they're handed out. They're life-changing.
No, Bob, I couldn't agree more. And I think step one is to, well, there's many steps, but, you know, step one is to get the information straight. But I totally agree about shifting the narrative around how we conceptualize mental illness. We also have to address the diagnostic conundrums, the diagnostic inflation. Once we get those out of the way, then we can see, okay, you know, I'm not even, again, like I said off the top, I'm not even sure what mental illness is anymore, to be totally honest.
Me neither.
Right?
Me neither. Right?
And this is so, I've been studying, well, I mean, I graduated from my experimental PhD in 2004. I completed my clinical respecialization in 2010. I've been in the field for, you know, like a good chunk of time, and I'm more confused than I ever was, to be honest. That tells you something, I think.
Yeah, I think the problem here is, and this is part of this, that we as a society need to rethink this whole thing.
100%.
We just need to rethink the whole thing. But it begins when you talk about mental illness, it sounds like there's some line out there. You're either ill or you're not ill, right? There isn't that line, doesn't exist in nature. It surely doesn't. And if we look, so we have this DSM, right, which I think is one of the most diluted books in the history of books in terms of the false presentation of humans that exists in that book. Like, because it pathologizes so many normal things. And so we need to recapture, we need to rethink. What do we see about humans from literature? What do we see it through theater? What do we see it from religious tracts? What do we see it from philosophy and history? And what we clearly see, if we take this big view, is A, it's hard to be a human being. It isn't this nice sort of la, 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 things are good. It's hard. We struggle with our minds. We struggle growing up with our behaviors and our minds. We're just not made to just move into like some sort of satisfactory place. Then life slaps you around, man. Life comes up and it smacks you in the face half the time. Whether it's poverty, whether it's a loss of job, a relationship, things can go south really fast. And then the other thing is, though, humans are resilient. You get knocked down, with time, you pick yourself back up. And life changes. Who you are today is not who you were 5 years ago or who you were 10 years ago. We change. And by the way, that's biological too. You know that your mind changes, your brain changes in response to your environment. That's what human beings are built to do physiologically, is respond to our environment emotionally and all. So what that tells you, to suffer is the norm, to struggle is the norm. And, you know, I think really within all of us, there's the capacity to go psychotic. Certain things can happen to you. Stop sleeping, first of all. But there's other things that can drive us there. So we need this thing of humility, the sense that we're not steady state beings. There's not this line, but also remember a sense of human beings are resilient. How do you nurture that resilience? And then you start to think like, what do we all need? What do you need to be well? What do I need to be well? Well, it really helps to have shelter, first of all, you know, a place to be safe. It's really important to have someone to love and someone to love you. Food is important. Exercise is important. Having meaning in life, which can come with a lot of different ways, is important. And for most people, having some sort of social connection is important. And then when you think of that as common to all human beings, and then if someone comes in and says, like, I'm divorced, or I'm working three jobs, or, you know, whatever it might be, come isolated, I'm afraid to go out, you can start seeing that these supports, these legs of wellness, one's missing or two are missing. And then you start saying, how can we rebuild environments how can we create environments that help sustain people better? And how can we give them a narrative of possibility for going forward? How can they imagine themselves, getting better, et cetera? And I think if you have that conception, you know, we can rethink this whole thing. And that's what we need to do. We need to rethink this whole thing around philosophy, resilience, optimism, what it means to be human.
Well, that's such a thoughtful take. And I think a lot of the listeners will feel really validated hearing that. I want to share one quick thing of when I used to work on an inpatient unit during my residency. We would always do this exercise that was really powerful and meaningful for people, where we would list their values on the board, like relationship, lifelong learning, friends, fun, self-care, all that kind of stuff. And then I would ask them, 0 to 100, how important are those values to you? Then they would rank them. And then in the next column, we'd say, okay, relative to that importance, how much of your behavior is going into fulfilling and nurturing that need or value in your life? And what we'd always see that their, you know, the way we would frame is that their depression was always living in the gap between how important something was to them and the amount of behavior going into it. And what we saw is that people who do well are able to map their behavior onto their values. They're able to fill in that gap, very much like what you're saying, right? So otherwise we just stick people in the hospital and, put them on drugs, and we would just wait for the drugs to run their course. But what we see is that when people come into for a hospitalization, often their life has fallen apart around them in many different domains. Many legs of the table have become wobbly or are gone, and we're reconstituting a human life, not just a brain, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And the problem is that medical model, in the hospital is particularly missing, right? You're just waiting for the drug to take effect, and then you're going to ship them back out with any sort of, I love that sense of the gap between what they value, because they know what they value because they've had experiences, and between what's going on with their life now. That provides an introspection, a window into understanding of how to change your life. I interviewed when I was doing Anatomy of an Epidemic, and I also run Mad in America, and you see all sorts of personal stories on there. When I was writing Anatomy of an Epidemic, I maybe interviewed 65, 75 people who had been in the hospital and were now doing better. But not one person told me a story that, oh, the drugs fixed me. Every single person also told a story about a relationship that happened. Sometimes a relationship with a psychiatrist, by the way, but something happened with another human being that they saw critical to their change in life. And sometimes it was simple. It's sort of what you're talking about, is maybe that relationship gave them some insight, but also that relationship made them feel they could be out in society and that they were worthy, and they were worthy of being loved and cared for. So, what you just talked about is like, it seems so common sense, right? That this is what we all need. And when people struggle, that means that something is missing. How do we help them get that back? And the problem with the medical model, beyond all the physiology we've talked about today, is the medical model, that disease model, let's not call it a medical model, it's a disease model. It says the problem's inside your own head. It's not in these in-between spaces or what's happening to you. And human beings, they don't exist in their head. That's not, the head is a reflection of what is happening with you in your environment, your world. And somehow that got missed from this disease model, as if there's some bacteria gets in your head.
Completely agree. And again, for listeners who haven't checked out the podcast that we did with Dr. Randy Nessie with the book Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, that's an amazing read that really dovetails quite nicely with the themes that we're exploring here today. Well, Bob, listen, I want to be respectful of your time, and you've been so generous with your time today. I highly, highly recommend to listeners to pick up Anatomy of an Epidemic. And Bob, you had mentioned Mad in America, but if people are interested in learning more about what you're up to or your latest projects, where can they find you?
Well, you can go onto this website called madinamerica.com. And if you look at the menu, so we do a lot of things there. We have personal stories, we have science reviews, we have drug resources, we have our own journalistic efforts, articles and all. But you can contact me by going up to the menu bar. It says about, contact, and you can send me an email. Or you can just send me an email at rwhitaker@madinamerica.com. I'm pretty good at responding to people. And really, that's what's taken up my time now. I mean, it's a daily webzine. We have a lot of people writing for us. We now have affiliate sites in a number of countries. It looks like there's going to be a Madden Canada startup in the next few months. So really, I'm engaged in this manner. Before the pandemic, I used to do a lot of speaking as well, but really engaged in an effort to help create or be a forum for fostering a new narrative. Because that's clearly what we need. And by the way, the outgoing special rapporteur for health, Danius Puras, at the United Nations, he has called for a revolution. We need a revolution. And he said, we need a new narrative. And actually, there are people associated with Madden America that have been helping him with this writing and this thinking and this conception. So I think the time is right. So many people said this narrative has failed. It hasn't worked in any way. We need to rethink things along a more humanistic, a more holistic place. And that's what I'm engaged in, trying to be a forum for information, personal stories that will help flesh out a new narrative.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, if you look at outcomes in psychiatry and psychology, we really haven't improved much over our initial gains. So to my mind, we've mapped the problem inaccurately, right? Without accurate mapping, you're not going to be able to get the proper results. So again, I come back to that sort of, I know it sounds like a bit of a strange question, but what is mental illness anyway? Let's start by getting that right. Then we can truly start to evaluate how we're doing and whether what we're doing makes any sense or not. So really appreciate the thoughtfulness and nuance in all your answers today. I think the listeners are going to find it fascinating. I hope we get the chance to speak again.
I hope so too. I really enjoyed it. And thanks so much for having me, Pete.
Thanks so much, Bob. Take care.
You too.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.